طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we feature a renegade Israeli journalist and activist, Haggai Matar, who is executive director of a publication company which publishes a magazine in English entitled 972 and a parallel publication published in Hebrew titled Local Call. Both publications are known for their critical coverage of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Haggai has been on tour in the United States and appeared in several venues in the Boston area. This morning you will hear his presentation in Lincoln, Massachusetts. First you will hear his main presentation, followed by an excerpted question and answer period. Here is Haggai Matar of 972 Magazine. 972 are the call numbers used to make an international call to Israel.
Thank you all for coming this afternoon, and thank you, Steve, for that lovely introduction and surprise quote from that book. It was actually part of my testimony in the court-martial, having spent 2 years in prison. That was actually a story I told there to the court as like one of the reasons why I chose to refuse, kind of the earliest stages in the development of my understanding of whether I want to go to the army or not. So that was kind of an understanding, oh, the army is not what they were telling us about. It's not there to protect us. It's there to fight people such as myself, apparently, going on a peaceful convoy. So thank you for that. But I'm here, as Steve said, as the executive director of 972, and I want to talk a little bit about the world of media in Israel, and I want to say two, maybe three basic things, and that's first how Israeli media, mainstream media in Israel, is not an ally of the progressive camp. It is not an ally of anyone supporting a peaceful solution, an end to the occupation, social justice, decent foreign policy. All those things are not something that you can find in mainstream media in Israel. The second thing that I want to talk about is how, in spite of this, in the past few years, the government and others around its closest supporters have been waging an attack on mainstream media, in spite of it being fairly supportive of the occupation, and I want to say a little bit why. And the third thing is how I think alternative media, such as 972 Magazine and Local Call, which we publish, can offer an answer to both the problems and the faults of mainstream media and the attacks by the government, and how this is connected with things that are happening globally and here in the U.S. So to start, I first realized the problems of the mainstream media in Israel already as an activist when I was 16 and 17, later refused and went to prison. And after that, as I became very involved in demonstrations, the popular demonstrations against the wall and settlements in villages such as Bil'in and Masara and Abisalach and others. And I would go to these demonstrations as an activist, a young activist, and I would see the huge gap between what was happening on the ground and what was being reported in mainstream media, and it was a painful gap, and it was that's for in two different ways. Like one way would be for the media to just ignore demonstrations if they were completely nonviolent, if they were there were no stones thrown and no army, no clashes with the army or anything like that. Just masses of people marching and peacefully resisting land grabs and settlement construction of the wall, then that would never be reported. And when there were confrontations, they would always be portrayed as though the Palestinians are responsible. And this is even the most extreme cases, perhaps, when I went to this one demonstration in Bil'in once, and the organizers wanted, they know that at some point in the demonstration, people start throwing stones and the army shoots tear gas, but they wanted the first phase of this specific demonstration, which was unusually large, to be completely nonviolent. And as people were marching, a few people started throwing stones. And the organizers went to them and told them, look, we don't want this for this phase. We're trying to have a nonviolent protest. And the people throwing stones took out badges, and it was apparent that they were soldiers undercover as demonstrators, throwing stones to create a media image of the protesters starting the violence vis-a-vis the army. And they started arresting the people trying to stop them from throwing stones from within the protest at the other soldiers. And you know, this was a crazy thing to see. But then I got back home and I saw how the media was reporting it. And once again, it was like this riot in Bil'in, Palestinian violent terrorists and their, you know, international or local Israeli allies attacked soldiers and so on and so on. And this has no room for what happened to be reported in mainstream media. And this is even when they do report. And like I said before, the nonviolence resistance is never reported. And even more than that, just the day-to-day lives, what people experience as life under occupation, what it means to go through checkpoints or to suffer from administrative detention without trial, or the day-to-day meaning of living under occupation is something that you just don't find in mainstream Israeli media. The same goes to a lesser degree toward 48 Palestinians with Israeli citizenship that live inside the Green Line, but also their stories are not reported enough in mainstream media. And this reality that I recognized first as an activist was one of the things that drew me into becoming a journalist. I thought then I would go there, I would be part of the system, and I would change it. I would start reporting these things that aren't reported elsewhere. And I became, in the beginning, a municipal correspondent in Tel Aviv. I was reporting for one of the biggest newspapers called Ma'ariv. And very early on in my job there, I remember going to my editor and pitching a story which I had learned about. This was a family living in Jaffa, so it's in my turf. They were about to be evicted from their public housing apartment. And the two parents were suffering from disabilities. So I thought, this is, you know, something that we should report on. If the city is kicking out people from their home, and it's part of a gentrifying process in Jaffa, it's something to talk about. And my editor was very quick to ask me, are they Jewish or are they Arab? And I said, well, they're Arab. They just happen to be Arab. She said, okay, so that's not a story, she said. We can't report that. Our readers don't want to read that stuff. And it was so blunt. It was so, you know, she wasn't even trying to go around this question. And I was actually quite shocked. And I would later find out that this wasn't a one-time case. It was time and time again that stories were ruled upon and decided whether or not we publish according to the identity of the people whose stories are being told. They're citizens. They suffer from the same ills of the system. But if they're Arab, their stories aren't told. Over time, I became a member of the board of the Journalists Union in Israel. As a union, we've been organizing meetings of journalists to talk about our different experiences, either labor issues or other freedom of information, freedom of press issues. And one of the things that came up was that 9 out of 10 journalists that I had spoken to in events have gone through the exact same experience in their very different desks, newspapers, radio, television, internet. 9 out of 10 journalists had experienced going to an editor saying, I have this story, you know, someone was wronged, someone was injured, someone is being mistreated for some reason, and if they're Arab, that's not a story. The thing is, it's very scientific. I once spoke to a senior analyst on Channel 2 News. This is the most prominent, by far, most prominent television news show. And he told me that they follow the ratings that they have. And they know that any story that includes Arabs, the ratings drop. So, you know, they have very, very high ratings, and they drop, and people zip away, and then come back when the story is over. So for them, being driven by profit, obviously, they can't afford having too many stories about Arabs, about Palestinians, if it's not the utmost importance, which is violence, terrorism, security issues, stories that also reaffirm what the viewers already think of Palestinians, so they would stay. But if they hear a story about, you know, Palestinians being mistreated, then that's kind of a turnoff for viewers. So they just don't do it if they don't have to. So this is a brief description of the ills of mainstream media's treatment of Palestinians. At the same time, as I was saying before, in recent years we've been seeing an attack by the government against the media, something that might seem not too unfamiliar for Americans over the past year. But we've had this going for quite a long time. It started around 2009. We started seeing a process since the Gaza War, the first of three Gaza wars in 2009. We started seeing a process wherein the government is starting to become more and more authoritarian towards Israeli Jews within Israel. And this process that we've been seeing in attacking any institution that symbolizes democratic thought, liberal thought, not towards Palestinians, again, only towards the Jewish residents and citizens of Israel, is coming under attack. And this includes the judicial system, civil society organizations, the media, the academic world, and others. Just last week, in the opening of the winter session in Knesset, President Ruvi Rivlin, who is the official head of state, he doesn't have any power, but the head of state there, said that he fears the government is performing a coup against all other democratic institutions in the country. So, and this is him saying this after 8 years of an ongoing process by the government. And what we've been seeing, and here I should say there's a split between the government's attacks on Palestinian media and journalists and Israeli journalists. There's quite a difference. With the first, what we see and have been seeing throughout the occupation is media outlets being shut down with a military warrant and no explanation. Just 2 weeks ago, 8 of them were shut down by a military warrant in the West Bank. Journalists can be arrested and detained without trial or charge for what they call administrative detention, and this can go on for months on end. Journalists can be shot at or beaten, and all sorts of things. So that's for Palestinian journalists. Israeli journalists do not suffer the same treatment. It's not as bad as that. But we have been seeing, this is the escalation of recent years, we have been seeing more and more attacks that they would start with incitement by Netanyahu, not unlike Trump, kind of pointing the finger either generally at the media or specific journalists or specific media outlets, saying they're foreign agents, they are lying to you, they're hiding all the great things that my government is doing, they are allies of the New Israel Fund and the extreme left, and therefore are not to be trusted. So kind of this ongoing incitement. And at the same time, what we've been seeing is new regulations by police, just enforced as of 3 weeks ago, limiting the access of journalists to cover demonstrations. So now policemen can decide that the presence of journalists is a cause for violence in a demonstration. The existence of someone there documenting is creating the violence, so it's best to drive away the journalists first and then deal with the demonstrators. So this is fairly new. It's being challenged by the Journalists Union and ACLU, which is the ACLU in Israel. It's being challenged in the Supreme Court, this new policy, but it is part of what's been going on. We've been seeing a rise in the intervention of the military censorship with stories. 1 in 5 stories filed with the military censor, and you have to file all stories that have to do with the censorship, with the security or foreign relations, have to be filed in advance with the military censor. And one in five stories is being intervened with. Most aren't deleted, but they would ask you to change something, to remove something, and you're not allowed to say or even indicate that the censor has intervened with this story. We can't like leave a blank or just note, you know, something has been dropped here. So we've seen a rise in the censor's intervention recently, also with Facebook pages. They started for the first time approaching operators of Facebook pages, saying you too, not only mainstream media, have to go through us. And we've been seeing a rise in gag orders issued by the courts. There are three times more gag orders the past year than there have been 15 years ago, and there's a constant rise of 20% per year the past 3 years. So all these things have been happening, while also Netanyahu is trying to pass several different kinds of new regulations limiting the freedom of the press. And all these things have been happening. And while the media, mainstream media, is concerned about this, they're not really fighting it so far. With the union and some of the alternative media trying to combat these measures, but mainstream media is, so far, most outlets are just taking care of themselves. And what I want to say is what we can do as an alternative media outlet. As Steve was saying before, we run 972 Magazine. It's a blogger-based, volunteer-based journalistic outlet that we've been publishing for a little over 7 years now. It's based on Israeli and Palestinian journalists and bloggers and photographers throughout the land reporting, and few editors that are professional journalist editors that edit proof, fact-check, and publish the stories. And what we can, and we have the parallel site, which is Local Call in Hebrew. And what we can do with these things is try to challenge both the downsides of the media and the attacks by the government. I'll just give you two examples. One is a story that happened this January, January 18th, in the village of Umm al-Khiran in the Negev. This is a Bedouin village considered unrecognized by the government, which means that even though the people there have been living there for dozens of years and actually settled there by the government many years ago, it's not legal. And the government recently decided that this village would be destroyed and replaced with a Jewish settlement. Again, this is Israeli citizens in the Negev, not the West Bank. And on January 18th, a mass police force arrived with bulldozers to start destroying homes. One of the residents of the village got into a car and started driving away, and police opened fire and killed this person in his car. The car then lost control and hit a policeman, killing him as well. The police had put a siege around the village so that reporters hearing about this development could not come in. And at the same time, police was releasing statements that an Islamic terrorist has committed a ramming attack against a policeman, killing him and then thus forcing police to open fire and killing the terrorist as well. All media outlets in Israel published this story as is, not like police is saying that. Just, you know, an ISIS attacker, they even said that he was probably connected with ISIS. So like an ISIS attacker killing a policeman in Umm al-Khiran. We were the only media outlets to have had people in the village from the night before, so we weren't affected by the siege. We thought that this destruction of the village is a big story, even without the bloodshed, just the fact that the village is being destroyed, so we made sure we'll be there ahead of time. And we were able, while on the scene, to get eyewitness testimonies from people that saw the shooting and were able to testify that the person was driving away, that he was shot at for no reason. And within hours, by publishing these testimonies on our sites, we changed the discourse in the entire Israeli media. Within hours, other media outlets had to retract their initial statements, to change their headlines, to embed the videos that we had of people testifying about what they had seen, and retell the story. So they might have had questions. They might have said, there are two versions to this story. We don't know what's truth yet. And with time, they found out that we were right all along. But still, they had to change their initial statements. So by just being on the ground in places that usually the media doesn't think matter, and by just being there and reporting the truth and making sure that we can document it with videos, with documents, with footage, we can make a difference in how mainstream media is reporting. The second thing we can do is challenge the attacks on the media. For many, many years, unfortunately, the journalist union was not concerned with the attacks of the government against Palestinian journalists. So when journalists were put in administrative detention, the journalist union just didn't take any action. The coverage in 972 magazine and Local Call has gradually forced the union to take a stand, because we would approach, and I'm in two hats here because I'm both in these sites and a member of the board, which was in a minority there, but we would approach the union for a comment, why aren't you doing something about this latest administrative tension of, for example, a board member in the Palestinian union that's a colleague of yours? Why are you not doing anything about this? And eventually, after about a year and a half of pressure, just this year, a few months ago, for the first time, the journalist union decided to take action and oppose detention of Palestinian journalists. So we are making a difference. And the last thing I want to say before opening this up for questions, it's a small room so we can have a lively debate, I hope, is that these issues that we are facing and dealing with, I think both with media, but even more so with the government, are not an isolated Israeli story. They're part of a global trend. They're part of a global development of authoritarian or quasi-authoritarian regimes on the rise here in the US and in Eastern Europe and Turkey and Russia and Israel. And these regimes and these leaders, they're connected with each other. They learn from each other. They operate together. They act locally but think globally. They recognize the similarities of their opponents and of their own goals. We can see this with the people leading these different kinds of processes. For example, Sheldon Adelson, a prominent Republican supporter here, millionaire and casino mogul that has casinos from Macau to Las Vegas, supports Republican candidates here and the Republican cause here, owns media outlets here in the U.S., and owns the number one most widely spread and read newspaper in Israel that is a patron of Netanyahu, called Israel Hayom. And it's a free paper. It's given out free throughout the country. And in several years, it has become the number one most read newspaper just because they're giving out free throughout the country. So these people on Breitbart, for example, Andrew Breitbart, I don't know how many people know this, but he thought of setting up a site to challenge mainstream media from the right when he was in Jerusalem. The first time he had thought about this, he was in Jerusalem, and he said to a bunch of friends, and this is in a book about his legacy, he talked to his friends and said, we need to set up a site to counter the J Street pro-Palestinian lies in the media, and so we can start with that. So these people, they recognize the similarities and how they're leading a joint struggle. And the reason that I'm here is to say that we should perhaps be thinking the same. We should be recognizing that we are leading the same struggles here and in Israel, Palestine, and many other places. So supporting the cause of Israelis and Palestinians resisting the occupation and resisting the authoritarian trends of our government is not kind of, you know, supporting a distant cause out of charity. It is thinking politically about one struggle that is becoming global. That's it. Thank you.
Yes, yeah, to tag on to more about similar struggles, a lot of us are frustrated too that our media doesn't talk about these things. Mm-hmm. How receptive or not have you found American media to your message?
That varies, really. I think on a whole, American media is hard. A hard nut to crack for us. I am happy to say that we know that journalists covering our region read 972 magazine regularly, and not just journalists, like politicians, diplomats. If you look at the Clinton letters, you can see several links to 972 magazine, so we know Hillary was reading or at least being sent links to 972 magazine. So we know we have an influence that goes beyond, you know, the kind of immediate choir, if you will, that follow us. And we see this effect as sometimes our stories would be picked up by mainstream media. And the same kind of thing I was telling you about Israeli media picking up our story on Umm al-Khiran and changing its narrative, we have been seeing, not with all American media, but definitely with the New York Times, would often quote either directly or indirectly stories that we've had, and you could see the discourse changing, and we're trying to be in touch with reporters in The Nation and The Washington Post and New York Times and others to kind of offer them a different framework to understand what is happening in our region.
So there's some progress?
There is. It's gradual, but it's happening, yes.
Are the journalists who write for 972 employees of 972, or are they freelancers who submit stories? And how do you position people? You said you got someone to that village in the Negev the night before because you knew things were going to happen. How easy it is to place people where they need to be and get the story?
So the way that the two sites are built is kind of a bottom-up system of volunteer journalists. So only each site only has two editors that are staff, basically, like 2.5 for local call. So that are staff, that are working on the site. All the others are volunteers. And how we do this is just by having people that are politically active or involved or just deeply care about stories. And because it's bottom-up reporting, it's not, unlike regular stories, it's not that you would have an editor saying someone has to go and commission or send someone out to the field, but you'd have a WhatsApp group of all the volunteers for both sites just saying, okay, there's a demolition tomorrow morning, does anyone want to go? And someone would say, yes, of course, I'm already on my way because I was invited by the people there or because I live nearby and I'm part of the struggle, and we'll just go there. If we can't get anyone to volunteer, then we try to rely on other sources, we try calling people in the scene. Actually, right now, for the first time next year, 2018, it's going to be the first year that we are starting to grow our operations, and for the first time we will be starting to commission stories. It's after 7 years we feel that we have kind of reached the maximum potential of the volunteer model. So for the first time, this obviously means an increase in our budget. We will start paying and commissioning stories that we feel are missing and are important.
Can you comment on the push to shut down Al Jazeera now?
Mm-hmm. Like here in Israel, and I think it's terrible. I mean, it's part of that ongoing attack that I've been mentioning. Of course, it has different levels. So yes, in Israel, for example, they're trying to revoke the press cards for Al Jazeera. They're trying to shut down their offices. It's very complicated because there are still laws in place that don't really allow the government to do whatever it pleases. So it's an ongoing battle there. I think it's dangerous, and the union is very much involved in this. The first Al Jazeera correspondent that was told that he would lose his official press card appealed the decision, and the union represented him, and the decision was overturned. So, but it's an ongoing battle. Like, the week after that, the government press office, which issues press cards, had this kind of convention to discuss freedom of speech in the case of Al Jazeera. And they wanted the head of Al Jazeera to be there and speak about freedom of speech and freedom of press. And then they were told by the prime minister's office, that is like above, they're part of the Prime Minister's office, that they can't have him speak in this debate on freedom of press. So they cancelled the invite, and they had a Jewish-only panel of people speaking against Al Jazeera in this debate about the case of Al Jazeera, which is, you know, just obnoxious, I think. But but I think legally we have tools to protect them.
Several weeks ago, maybe months ago, there was talk that Netanyahu and his wife were going to be indicted any minute.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
His wife is probably being indicted. That's imminent. I don't know, like, you know, could be a few more weeks, but it's happening. And Netanyahu himself is not as close to that right now. There are several criminal investigations. At least one of them is likely to lead to an indictment, but that would take it'll take a while. Like, the police has to reach its conclusion, then make a recommendation to the general attorney, and then he has a hearing, and, you know, it can go on forever.
If he's indicted, will the government fall? Will there be no elections?
No, he already said that even if indicted, he doesn't think himself that he should step down. And there's a legal question on that. It's actually legally unclear whether or not he has to step down. In the past, when prime ministers were indicted, they just chose to step down. As he already said this, if he is indicted and he doesn't step down, someone would probably go to the Supreme Court and say that he has to. And it'll be an interesting precedent case on that. So there's always a fear, though, that he would try and have either earlier elections, a war, or both, to kind of shift attention away. That's the one thing everybody's like most scared of, that to shift attention away from corruption charges, he would turn to very incitementful election campaign, or a war, or both.
I admire your position on the military experience. How did you survive those 2 years, and was your imprisonment equal to what a Palestinian would have experienced?
No. I spent part of my time in military prison, so that's only for soldiers, basically. And then at some point I was transferred to civilian prison, but in the civilian prison system, there's like segregation between Israeli citizens, Jewish and Palestinian, and non-citizens, so Palestinians from the occupied territories. So they have different conditions, they're in different areas. So I actually had a friend of mine, a Palestinian friend of mine, that we were in the same prison, but in different wards. So we would correspond by, I would send like a letter out to my family, they would give it to his family that would then come to visit him, like, you know, literally like across the wall from me, and give him that letter, and vice versa. And in terms of surviving it, I mean, you know, it was difficult. It wasn't violent or brutal, or, you know, it wasn't dangerous in any way. It was just a difficult experience. I mean, prison is a very, very difficult place to be in. I think looking back at it, being young was also a challenging experience, being the youngest in prison, civilian prison. But I think I just went through it first because, you know, we don't really have a choice. So I didn't expect going to 2 years. Most conscientious objectors usually go to prison for a term of between 2 to 4, maybe 5 months. So that was what I had expected. I actually had plans. I had like plans for what I'm going to do right after. And then at the time, this was 2002, it was the height of the Second Intifada, and there was a wave of conscientious objection, and suddenly dozens of people were refusing at the same time. And the army recognized that as a threat, whereas they would usually have up to like 5 people in prison. Suddenly they had 40 at a time, at any given moment. So they singled out a few of us that they identified as like prominent activists in the movement, and court-martialed us. And then it suddenly became this massive thing in 2 years. But what kept me going, aside from the fact that I just had to because I was there, was knowing that this is actually having an impact, that our trial was getting massive coverage in the media. It was talked about, it was discussed both locally and internationally. It was a big thing, and we were receiving, you know, bags full of letters of support from people worldwide, from Palestinians, saying, you know, we gave up on the Israeli society, but then we heard that you people are refusing, and, you know, that's a ray of sunlight for us. So for us, that was, you know, an inspiration and a reason to keep going.
If you refuse to join the army, how could you be court-martialed? Don't you have to be in the army to be court-martialed?
It's actually a technicality. When the day comes, when your draft date comes, you don't have to do anything to become part of the army. You're automatically drafted. you're transferred. So this is how it happens. You're transferred from the computers of the Ministry of Interior to the Ministry of Defense. You become a soldier, and then you're actually sentenced not for refusing the draft, but for disobeying the order of becoming a soldier. That was the actual letter of the law that I was sentenced for, disobeying the order of becoming a soldier.
Thank you
Yeah.
Could you speak to the migration issue of especially the younger people leaving Israel, and then the immigration issue of the more conservative people going to Israel? Can you speak to the notion of what's happening?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't have exact numbers. To the best of my knowledge, there's not a significant rise in immigration to Israel. Sometimes there would be a bit of a wave, but like if you look over the years, there isn't a massive trend right now or anything like that that's happening. With people leaving, that's a different case. Many people are leaving to all sorts of places for all sorts of reasons. The US, Berlin, and Russia are like the three most popular destinations. For Russia, it's mainly people that emigrated and are just giving up and going back, usually because they feel rejected by the Israeli society. They feel they can't integrate. And the others are people, I think some people, not many, leave for political reasons, just giving up on society and saying, you know, there's no way to fight here, or feeling, I mean, it's a rough place to live in, and you want peace and quiet. I mean, I'm actually staying with a friend that left the country and lives here in Boston, and Waltham, actually, and I'm staying with her, and she, you know, she's still a political activist here on the same issues, but, you know, I can see her day-to-day life in the beautiful foliage and, you know, the trees and the serene views and the nice people of Greater Boston. And I, you know, I really, really can understand. I mean, it really, really makes sense to live here and not go through the ongoing day-to-day struggles there. But the number one reason for people leaving, and I have met people, I stayed in New York before with other friends that came here, and are saying that it's just pure economic reasons. The price of living in Israel is extremely high, salaries are low, everything costs a fortune, housing, basic utilities, everything costs so much that it's very, very hard just to make a living and support a family. So people just leave because of that. And I've been speaking to so many Israelis here that just tell me, you know, I miss home and I want to go back, but I can't make it economically. I can't afford living home.
I have two questions. I'll ask them. I'd like you to answer the first one first, then I'll ask the second question.
Okay.
The first question is that here in the U.S., we've provided for decades now unqualified, uncritical support for the government of Israel and its policies. To some degree, many of us believe that this is driven to a large degree by politics, and particularly at the national level by AIPAC, and perhaps at the more local or state levels by Jewish federations. We're fighting in Massachusetts right now anti-BDS legislation. The federation obviously is supporting it, in fact, they wrote the bill. So the question that I have for you is, what would you tell the American Jewish community if you could address the American Jewish community? And by that I mean the whole community, not just the left side of the community, but the right side. What would you tell the American Jewish community about what this country could be doing or should be doing to help resolve this issue?
I'm not sure I would have the same message for the left and for the right here, but generally speaking, I would go back to saying that we have to recognize, and I think not enough people recognize, the choice that Israeli governments, consecutive governments, for many, many years now, have been making in Israel to maintain the occupation and the status quo, as I was saying before. I mean, that is like the one thing that I often find people don't understand. People say Israel is offering its hand in peace, it's looking for ways. Nobody is doing that. I mean, Netanyahu is very, very clear about, I'm not going to take down any, well, not a single settlement. He just said this recently. There's no negotiations happening. The head of the opposition, Avi Gabay, recently said, I too am not going to take down any settlement. And not to say that he wants to, either of them want a one-state solution with the settlements or anything, just, you know, there's not going to be any agreement. And Yair Lapid, the third contester for government, also says there will be no agreement, there will be no dismantling of settlements, the occupation will not end. All of the possible runner-ups for Prime Minister in the near future are basically saying there will not be peace. And we will not negotiate, or maybe we'll negotiate because it looks good, but we'll not sign a peace agreement. And people have to understand that. So then you can say, people can make a choice. They can say, okay, we don't care. We support Israel if it's an occupying power. We support Israel if it violates human rights. We, you know, if you want to do that, then, you know, fine. Keep on going with the way you have been. You know, it's been working. So, you know, you can go on. But if you do support any kind of peaceful solution, if you do think that the occupation is immoral wrong, and that the future, even of Jewish Israelis in that land, is something that is supposed to last for the long run, then the answer has to be ending the occupation in peace. And for that, something dramatic has to change. Because the status quo can go on for a very, very, very long time, as we have seen. We're not in point of, you know, assuming what might happen. This is like 50 years since the 67 occupation, and even more than that with discrimination within Israel. So this has been going for a very, very long time. If you want to change that, something has to change. It's not going to come from within Israel, unless something very, very surprising happens, but it probably won't. So there are only two other factors at play here that can make a difference. One is a massive Palestinian uprising that right now I do not see in the cards. This is not any way clear. Of course, these things happen sometimes out of the blue, as we've seen. You know, 2011 taught us a lesson in predicting what kind of revolutions might or might not happen. But still, right now it seems that this is not something that's going to happen. Israeli public opinion is not going to change. So the third option is international pressure. So if you want something to change, you need to start utilizing pressure. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in the exact same position. That was one.
That's okay. So that plays into my second question, right. Is would you care to comment on the BDS movement, the boycott investment sanction movement, and the role that might play?
Yeah, sure. So I think BDS is a good example of such possible pressure. I should say this is not like, and many other things I've been saying here, is not like an official position of 972s, also because that would be illegal in Israel. But even besides that, our position is against the occupation without supporting any specific solution or tool. But personally, I think BDS is a non-violent tool and a useful tool in pressuring Israel. So I do think that's important and it's something that can be used. Yeah.
Do you think it's having any effect on...
I don't think so. I mean, the one thing that it's been doing so far, and this is... it's not gotten to the point yet where it's actually having an effect where people say, okay, we have to choose, like, you know, commerce with the world or occupation. I mean, we're not at that point. It's become this thing that the government would often use as a tool to incite against civil society, kind of pointing fingers and saying they're working with someone, that works with someone, that has once said something supportive of BDS, so, you know, boycott them. So it's kind of helping the government right now to single out political activists. So right now that's bad, of course, but I do think that in the long run it might have a better effect if it's, you know, a stronger movement.
So that's interesting. What I think I hear you saying is that Israel does use boycott. They suggest that people boycott what they don't agree with. So there is something within Israel that agrees with the boycott as long as
it's the right boycott. Yeah, as long as it's the right boycott.
So, but
yeah.
They agree with that.
Yeah, it's a political tool. Right. It's a political tool. Yeah. So,
I think that's an interesting thing to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you can see the government itself is as part of its attack on different democratic institutions. Mm-hmm. For the past year, or even more, it's starting to take away funds from all sorts of, mainly in the world of culture, theaters, film productions, mm-hmm. and so on, if they do anything that it doesn't like. So that is sort of a boycott by the government. I mean, the government is responsible for sponsoring theaters in Israel. It's by law. They have to support theaters, but they changed the law so they can remove support for anything that is supportive of terror. And the definition of supportive terror is very, very, very wide. So, for example, just recently, there's a Palestinian poet that is under arrest, was detained in prison for, I think, 9 months, and since then, 9 more months has been in house arrest for a poem that she published on Facebook. And there was an evening of solidarity with her in a theater in Jaffa. And just for being in solidarity with the poet that published a poem that the government finds offensive, that theater might now lose its public support, its government support. So, and there are and others that are organizing to be in support of that theater might also lose their funding. So this is kind of this ongoing process where the government is, as you say, boycotting in a way itself.
You have been listening to Israeli journalist and activist Haggai Matar of 972 Magazine speaking at the Lincoln Library. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.